The high priest entered the Holy of Holies bearing incense and coals. He poured the incense upon the coals, which sat facing the Ark of the Covenant. The high priest was suffused by the smoke and experienced an intimacy with the Almighty unlike any other. Only then was he prepared to offer the blood of the offerings in that most sacred of spaces. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Acharei Mot, the University Seal and the Light of God. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World, is generously sponsored by Ivan Kaufman. Rabbi Soloveitchik's podcasts and essays on the Book of Leviticus are generously sponsored by Dr. Michael Schmerin and his family. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Maurice Aguillon.
If you wander around the older, more historic universities in the United States and study the seals of these institutions etched into the buildings, you will find a fascinating feature. Hebrew words with Hebrew letters, usually invoking both the names of God and the theme of, or, light. Go up to New Hampshire and visit Dartmouth, and you will see its seal adorned with the Hebrew names of God, Kael Shakai, with light radiating forth from the Hebrew words. Even more interesting is the seal of Yale, which features a book within which appear two Hebrew words, Urim v'Tumim, along with a Latin translation, Lux et Veritas, light and truth. Why is the phrase there? Yale professor Dan Oren points out that the words Urim v'Tumim appear in the middle verse of the Torah, which means that the book is meant to represent the Pentateuch. Light is a metaphor for enlightenment, reason, the search for truth. The symbol, as he explains, is meant to connote that for Yale's leaders at the time, biblical revelation and human reason were meant to go hand in hand. Perhaps most interesting of all is the seal of Columbia University, which features the Shem Hashem, the ineffable name of God, the letters Yud-Heh and then Vav-Heh, with rays of light emanating from it, along with the Hebrew words Uri-El, the Lord is my light. The seal embodies the conviction that the Hebraic heritage is the ultimate source of wisdom and truth, that it embodies a true source of enlightenment. Of course, there are a few today at Columbia and Yale who can read the words Uri-El or Urim v'Tumim on its seal, and even less who understand its context. This points to something striking. It was surely assumed by many that as faith disappeared from the domain of American universities, that freedom of inquiry, the unfettered exchange of ideas, would increase. But in fact, the opposite has occurred. The search for truth that is done through the free exchange of ideas has been replaced by other lesser notions, with truth itself being the victim. New York University's Jonathan Haidt, an alumnus of Yale, ruefully reflected that, quote, when I arrived at Yale in 1981, Veritas, meaning truth, was written in stone above Phelps Gate. We were told this is an institution committed to truth. But since the 1990s, increasing numbers of universities seem to be chiseling out truth and inserting change. Haidt's reflection is all the more relevant today as we see bona fide defenders of terror demonstrating and harassing Jewish students at some of the most distinguished institutions in the land. It is therefore all the more painful to ponder the original seal of Columbia, for it truly does embody a biblical idea of God and his Torah as the source of light, and the significance of the seal's symbolism can be better appreciated when we study our own weekly reading, wherein the light of God is experienced in the most remarkable of ways and in the most sacred of sites. The Parsha of Acharei Mot is most well known for its first section, which describes the Avodah, the service of the high priest in the tabernacle and temple on Yom Kippur. The ethical mores discussed in the second part of the Parsha are also addressed in next week's reading and will be the focus of Parsha and Politics next week. The cultic rites and rituals of Yom Kippur are complex and often misunderstood, and they must therefore be succinctly summarized in order for us to understand their metaphysical meaning as well as their philosophical significance. Let us first focus on the metaphysical aspects of this passage, drawing on the writings of Jacob Milgram. Throughout the year, the Bible informs us, the sins of God's people bring some purity in the temple, and it is on Yom Kippur that the place must be purified. Our Parsha states, thus he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurity of the people of Israel and because of their transgressions, their sins. And so he shall do for the tent of meeting, which abides with them in the midst of their impurity. It is sacrificial blood that is utilized for the purification of the sacred sphere. For blood, we are told in our reading, is the very symbol of life. Again, our Parsha states, for the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by reason of the life. On this most sacred of days, the high priest offers a bull on behalf of himself, his household, and all priests. He also performs a lottery to select between two goats, one of which is offered on behalf of God's people. The blood of these two offerings, the bull and the goat, are sprinkled in the Holy of Holies, purifying it of the defilement brought about by the sins of the people. That impurity is then withdrawn from the holy and bestowed by the high priest upon the other goat in the form of a confession. All this is described at the beginning of the reading. And Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and for his household. Then he shall take the two goats and set them before the Lord at the door of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it, that it may be sent away into the wilderness to Azazel. Often and accurately known as the rite of the scapegoat, what is actually occurring is that this goat, like the bird utilized in the purification of the Mitzorah in the previous parsha, is sent away, cast away in the wilderness known as Azazel in order to remove all impurity from the sacred sphere of Jerusalem. This is the metaphysical nature of the ritual, but what is often missed is the profound moral teachings behind it. As is made clear in our contemporary Yom Kippur liturgy, a series of confessions were recited by the high priest on that day. He began by beseeching forgiveness for himself and his family. Thus we say in synagogue on Yom Kippur, V'kach ha'yomer, and so he, the high priest, would say, Ana Hashem, I beg of you, O Lord, I have erred, been iniquitous, and willfully sinned before you, I and my household. I beg of you by your name, atone now for the errors, iniquities, and willful sins by which I have erred, been iniquitous, and willfully sinned before you, I and my household. After praying for his wife and children, the high priest then offered a confession and prayer for his fellow Kohanim, priests. Only after completing these confessions did the high priest turn to the sins of the entire nation. Again, V'kach haya omer, so he would say, Ana Hashem, I beg of you, O Lord, Chatu, Avu, they have erred, been iniquitous, and willfully sinned before you, your people, the family of Israel. The precisely ordered prayers are noteworthy. Here we have the high priest on Judaism's holiest day and Judaism's holiest site. All eyes are upon him as he represents his people before God. He begins by pondering his own imperfections and his family's frailties, their need of mercy from the Almighty. He then moves from there to ponder the Kohanim, the Jews that are his extended family. He then prays for the entire people. The performance embodies a millennia-old insight that loving particular people in a preferential way, focusing on those closest to us, actually enhances our understanding of the needs of others beyond our inner circle. Bar-Ilan University professor Zev Magen relates in an essay how he was once sitting in a restaurant in Tel Aviv when he heard that a plane crash in East Asia killed hundreds of people. Originally utterly unperturbed, he continued with his meal. He then paused, thought to himself how he would feel if those killed were Israelis, and suddenly found himself without an appetite. It is preferential love for one's own, he realized, that can lead to compassion for others. He wrote, quote, preferential love is the most powerful love there is, the only truly motivating love there is. It is by means of that love, the special love we harbor for those close to us, that we learn how to begin to love others who are farther away. Genuine and galvanizing empathy for the other is acquired most effectively and lastingly through a process which involves, first and foremost, immersion in love of self, then of family, then of friends, and of community. And he adds, it is via emotional analogy to these types of strong bond affections that one becomes capable of executing a sort of love leap, a transference of the strength and immediacy of the feelings one retains for his favorite people, smack onto those who have no direct claim on such sentiments. End quote. A love leap. This love leap is precisely what the high priest performs, from his immediate family to his extended family, and from there to all Israel. It is the blood of these offerings that would purify the temple, but before the blood was sprinkled in the Holy of Holies, the high priest would enter the same supremely sacred site bearing coals and incense, our parsha tells us. And he shall take a pan full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it within the veil and put the incense on the fire before the Lord. This was known as the most difficult, perilous, and profound service of the entire year. The high priest entered the Holy of Holies bearing incense and coals. He poured the incense upon the coals, which sat facing the Ark of the Covenant. The high priest was suffused by the smoke and experienced an intimacy with the Almighty unlike any other. Only then was he prepared to offer the blood of the offerings in that most sacred of spaces. To traditional Jews, this moment is famous, but few ever ask a question raised by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. In the Holy of Holies, there were no windows to be found. How then did the high priest make his way to the ark? How did he see? The answer, I think, can be found in what he held in his hands. Glowing coals, in Hebrew gachalei ish, taken from the outer altar of God. In the darkness, the only glow suffusing the area came from the coals of the altar of the Almighty. It was the only source of illumination in the dark at this most important time in this most special of places. To put it differently, it was the light of the coals there in the Holy of Holies as the path was paved for God's people away from sin toward atonement that showed the way. When everything was on the line, those coals remind us of the very verse in the Psalms that once was embraced by Columbia University, a biblical notion reflected in its seal. God is my light. Similarly, one finds, on Columbia's seal, the Latin phrase, in lumini tuo videbimus lumen, words which were originally given by the Jewish people to the world in Hebrew, in the Psalms, Be'orcha nira'or, by your light, God, we will see light. These are the coals of Yom Kippur. Thus, that one moment in the Holy of Holies with the light of God illumining the high priest's path toward the Ark of God, on the Day of Atonement, reflects what Judaism gave to the world as the safeguard against sin. The light that is the biblical moral vision. One does not need to be Jewish to recognize this. Justice Antonin Scalia, speaking at a Holocaust memorial event, reflected on the fact that Germany had once been the most cultured nation on earth, and yet this had not prevented its embrace of evil. This means, he argued, that education is not necessarily a path to enlightened living if biblical teachings are disregarded. As he put it, quote, it is the purpose of these annual Holocaust remembrances, as it is the purpose of the nearby Holocaust Museum, not only to honor the memory of the 6 million Jews and 3 or 4 million other poor souls caught up in this 20th century terror, but also by keeping the memory of their tragedy painfully alive to prevent its happening again. The latter, said Scalia, can be achieved only by acknowledging and passing on to our children the existence of absolute, uncompromisable standards of human conduct. Mankind, Scalia said, has traditionally derived such standards from religion, and the West has derived them from and through the Jews. End quote. So Scalia said, all this reminds us of the tragedy and travesty of what is unfolding in the American Academy today. In some universities, whose own seals proclaim what Judaism and the Hebrew Bible gave to the world, students in those very same institutions are turning on the Jews. And the vacuum left by the departure of biblical faith from the academy has meant that inevitably an entirely new religion has formed, one with its own dogma and doctrines, one in which the West, in which America, is seen as having an evil legacy. And according to this perverse worldview, it is the Jews that are described as oppressors, even when it is the Jews that have again been assaulted, violated, and murdered. In Uptown Manhattan today, the students of Columbia and Barnard can be seen traipsing into the magnificent Lowe Library on campus. On the foyer floor of the library is emblazoned the Columbia seal, complete with the biblical name of God, with rays of light coming out of it. Over the centuries, as those entering have stepped on the seal, the Hebrew letters of God's name has become effaced. It is a painful and perfect metaphor for the fact that many of those overseeing the most celebrated schools in America no longer see faith as essential to the pursuit of knowledge. America's spiritual crisis and its intellectual crisis, the crisis of its culture and academy, are intertwined. In this difficult moment, we draw inspiration from the image of coals glowing with the fire of God, taken from the fire of the altar, a fire which, as Leviticus tells us, was constant. Eish tamid tukad al mizbeach lo tichbe. An eternal fire shall burn on the altar, it shall never be extinguished. An eternal fire indeed. This fire represents the Jews themselves. The Jew, said Tolstoy, quote, is that sacred being who has brought down from the heaven the everlasting fire, and has illuminated with it the entire world, he whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy, he whom neither sword nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth, who has been for so long the guardian of the prophecy and transmitted it to the world, such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as is eternity itself. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together next week. Wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, signing off.